Welcome back into the Pick and Roll NBA podcast with Jet and Seth, presented by Full Press Coverage. We have two games down in the books in the NBA Finals, and believe it or not, the series is tied at one game apiece after the Miami Heat took Game 2 in Denver, 111-108, becoming the first team to beat Denver on their home court this postseason. And whether you believe in them or not, the Miami Heat just keep doing it. It sort of defies all logic at this point, Sap. I'm just sort of racking my brain trying to figure out how they're doing it, but they are. And tonight is game three, and it suddenly has become a massive, massive game as the series shifts to Miami. The Heat, obviously, were just hoping for a split in Denver, and now Denver is the team that has to answer the bell, especially the cohorts of Nikola Jokic, who was also fantastic in game two, but he didn't get nearly enough from Michael Porter Jr., who just had 5 points. And Jamal Murray was good, but they need more than 18 points from him.
Michael Porter Jr. is 3 of 17 on three so far in this series. So he's kind of channeling Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, how they performed in games 6 and 7 against the Miami Heat. Maybe the Heat are just really good at defending wings. Maybe that's the case, and that's why they're going to win the championship. We'll have to see what happens going forward. But the Miami Heat are kind of channeling the 0-1 Patriots, who there was no way they were going to beat the Raiders, right? And then they did that in the Snow Bowl. Then there was no way in hell they were going to Pittsburgh and win the AFC Championship game. Well, they did that with a punt return for a touchdown and a blocked field goal return for a touchdown and somehow got it done. And there was no way in hell they were going to beat the greatest show on turf. And they did on a game-winning field goal by Adam Vinatieri and one of their touchdowns coming on a pick six by Ty Law, like by any means needed. That was the mantra of that Patriots team, and it seems to be what the Heat do from game to game to game, and here they are. It's one game apiece. Denver was in control of this series for the first 7 quarters. They won the first game by 11. They led game two by 8 going into the fourth quarter, and what did the Heat do? They outscored the Nuggets 36-25 in the fourth quarter, and now this series is tied. I think what the Heat do better than anyone, Jet, and you probably will agree with this, is they play situational basketball better than anyone, like end of quarter. You know, they limit their turnovers, they hit their free throws, they do all the little things, and it adds up to victories, because in terms of matching up rosters, they had no business beating Milwaukee or the Celtics, and they'll have no business beating Denver, but they just get it done.
Yeah, it's sort of like I said at the top, Sap, it defies like basketball logic and what I've known for being a basketball fan my whole life. When you're talking about a team that could win a championship, you say, okay, a team needs two star players. Well, the Heat have one. And if they only have one, they need to be a top five player. Jimmy Butler isn't a top five player. He's playing fantastic, but he's not, you know, LeBron James. So he can't, you wouldn't think he'd be able to carry a whole team by himself. And then you other things you think, okay, well, you know, seeding is important. Well, not for the Miami Heat. They were the 8th seed. They just got in to the playoffs. You know, being a really good balanced team offensively and defensively is important. Well, the Heat weren't that at all in the regular season. Sort of everything, if you go up and down the box, up and down the list, checking off boxes of what a championship team has been throughout the 76-year history of the NBA, Miami doesn't really check any of those boxes, and yet here we are heading into Game 3 tonight, where they're 3 games away from winning the NBA championship, which would be, in my opinion, the most unlikely team to ever do it in the history of the NBA. And that's not hyperbole. That's legitimately how I would feel about it.
The team that you can compare it to, and I'm so old that I remember when they won a championship, the 1978 Washington Bullets, who also were 44-38 in the regular season, just like the Miami Heat. And if the Heat win this championship, they'll tie Washington of 1978 as the team that won a championship with the fewest wins. But that team had Wes Unseld, Elvin Hayes, both future Hall of Famers who were at the end of their careers. They also had Bobby Dandridge, who was a really good player, 5-time All-Star. And they got hot at the right moment, and then they beat the Seattle Supersonics, who were similar to them because they'd gotten off to a really slow start and got hot in the postseason. So it was two teams that were on this collision course coming from nowhere, and it ended up being a 7-game series, which Washington won in Seattle. So that's probably the comparison. But the point being that I think people are forgetting is if Miami pulls this off, the road to the championship would have been one of the most difficult that I can ever remember. Because if you look at the teams they would have had to beat to win that championship, a 58-win Milwaukee Bucks team, the number one seed in the East. Follow that with a 47-win team against the New York Knicks in round two, and then a 57-win Celtics team, the second overall seed in the Eastern Conference, to get to the NBA Finals. And then in the finals, a 53-win Denver Nuggets team who kind of took their foot off the gas at the end of the regular season. So you put those four teams together, the four opponents that Miami would have had to beat to win the championship were combined 215 and 113 this year, which is 63% winning percentage. That's really impressive. Like there were no layups on the road to winning the championship if they get it done. Now, conversely, Denver, I think, had a pretty easy road to trying to win their first championship in team history, because Minnesota in round two, an eight seed with 42 wins. Round two was Phoenix, a 45-win team. Then you face the Lakers, a 43-win team in the conference finals. And then if Denver wins this, they would have beaten a 44-win Miami Heat team. The four teams that Denver would have had to beat to win the championship are combined 174 and 154, which is 53% winning percentage. So you can just see the difference that the road that these teams have had to take are completely different. Now, again, this is all based on Miami winning it, which I still think is, I wouldn't say a long shot, but I still like Denver's chances here. But I think people are forgetting how good this Miami team is by just getting to the finals and who they had to beat. And that kind of things laid perfectly for Denver in the Western Conference.
Yeah, I mean, they've definitely had very, very different paths to get here, not just in the postseason, but, you know, they're in the regular season. The Heat had to, you know, fight to stay alive in the playoff race, whereas Denver, as you mentioned, Sepp, was sort of able to take their foot off the gas and coast a little bit at the end of the season, because they were in first place virtually from tip off of the season until the playoffs began. So very, very different paths to get here. And here they are tied at one game apiece. And I thought that this series would go five games, and that if there was going to be a game for Miami to win, it would have been game one. Denver had the long layoff. But after Denver won game one, I thought, okay, this really could end up being a sweep. And through a couple quarters, it looked like Denver was going to take care of business, no problem, in game two. But Miami comes storming back in the fourth quarter and wins the game. And it's just like you said, by hook or by crook, they seem to be able to figure out how to do it. I'm still looking at, you know, all these guys on the Miami Heat and not being able to figure out how this roster has gotten to this point. It's really remarkable, because it's not like, okay, your second best player is Bam Adebayo. He must have had a really good playoffs, right? He's been okay. He's been up and down. It's not like he's been consistently really good. They've gotten consistent play out of at least one of those like undrafted guys they talk about: Strus, Vincent, Duncan Robinson, Martin. But it's not like they've all played really well every single game. And it's not like Jimmy Butler has played phenomenal every single game. He's had some amazing games, but they seem to somehow find a way to have just enough to win games. And I again, am going to maintain, Sap, if they win, it would be the most unlikely NBA champion ever. And I'm not trying to jump on the Heat, but I think it's the worst championship roster that we would have ever had.
Sure. Yeah, because I'm comparing them to the 78 Bullets, but they had two Hall of Famers. And I think Jimmy Butler is going to be a Hall of Famer, but Unseld and Elvin Hayes were surefire Hall of Famers at that point. They were a little long on their tooth, but they had those two guys. And Bobby Dandridge, as their third best player, is better than the second best player on the Heat. But, you know, I don't want to go back 45 years ago, because, you know, the league is different then than it is now. Yeah, you can make a case that this would be the worst roster. And the thing with the Heat, Jimmy Butler's averaged 20 points per game over the last 10 playoff games. He's been okay, but nothing great. But he has a great feel for the game. He knows what he needs to do. He sets up his teammates. He's not concerned with what he's scoring. He plays defense. Adebayo's had some nice games, but some games where he disappears. But it always seems like two or three of those other guys, right, whether it's Caleb Martin or Gabe Vincent, Max Strus. I mean, Kyle Lowry's had some decent games at the age of 37. Kevin Love comes in and does what he needs to do in game two. Two of those guys or three of those guys step up, and it's just enough to get the job done. We saw that in game seven against the Celtics when it was Caleb Martin who was their leading scorer. In game two, it was Gabe Vincent. So there's just a player that steps up at the right moment and gets it done. It seems like two or three times in a given series, they shoot 50% from three.
Right.
If you shoot 50% from three, you're going to generally win. So there you are with winning two or three games based on 3-point shooting. And then they find a way to win another game when they're not shooting at that high level because they do play defense. And again, it goes back to they play great situational basketball. They make the proper adjustments and they do have the best coach in the NBA who, as this series unfolds, especially when you have a couple of days in between games, gets to work his magic.
So, Sap, that was kind of my next question for you. Is it as simple as the team that shoots better from three is going to win this series? Because that's the NBA now, Jack.
It really is.
Is that become like what's it called in baseball, the three true outcomes? Is that become the equivalent?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I looked at game two, and there's four ways you can score on a basketball court, right? I mean, there's more than four ways, but you can either score from inside the paint, beyond the arc, at the free throw line, or we'll call it the mid-range, which is between the paint and the arc. I mean, it's a little more detailed than that, but let's just go with those four true outcomes. Scoring in the paint, from the free throw line, beyond the arc, or the vast area of the court, which we'll call the mid-range.
Right.
There were 219 points scored the other night in game two. 219 points. Miami won 111-108. 84 of those points came from beyond the arc. 82 came from in the paint. 37 from the free throw line. A grand total of 16 points from the mid-range. Like, the biggest part of the court is not the paint or beyond the arc. It's everywhere else. And each team made four field goals from that area.
They ignore it, basically.
So if you're playing defense, if you're a coach, you're like, okay, protect the paint, protect beyond the arc, that other area, who cares? No one takes those shots anyway. I mean, each team scored one basket per quarter from that area. I mean, back in 1978, when the Bullets beat the Sonics, most of the points came from there because, first of all, there was no three-point shot back in 1978. Yes, you pounded the ball inside, but a lot of the points came from that mid-range. That's what the game is right now, Jet. You're so right. Whoever wins the three-point contest wins the game, and I think that's kind of bad for the sport, right?
I agree.
And now we can talk about this in a future podcast. How do you legislate it? Do you take the corner three out of it and just make the three from, you know, 15 feet out and make it kind of a semicircle? I don't know. I mean, these are things that can be examined. I think it's gotten to the point where it's just like, you look at who won the three-point battle, and you can pretty much guess that's the team that's going to win the game. I don't think that makes the game as exciting or as intriguing.
I agree. I do think it's hurt the game because you can look at the three-point percentage in, you know, like you said, in the game and determine the winner because the teams are jacking up on average between probably around 25 at the low end three-pointers a game. I'd say most
it's closer to 40. It's closer to 40. I mean, Miami the other night was 17 of 35. Look at what the Celtics were doing. I mean, the Celtics in game six and seven shot 77 3-pointers and they hit 16 of them. You know, so that's, Joe Mazzulla's theory would be take more, right? So, yeah, you're going to see 35, 40 3-pointers per game, roughly 40, 42% or whatever of all of your shots taken. And then everything else is in the paint because there's only two ways to score, right? At the rim or beyond the arc, everything else is useless, which I think is horrible. You know, Kevin Durant, who is one of the purest scorers I've ever seen, is great in the mid-range. So what's wrong with that? Maybe the greatest player ever. Michael Jordan, it takes me a little time to say his name when I say maybe the greatest player ever. But a lot of his points were at the rim, but even more so in that mid-range. Same thing with Kobe Bryant. Same thing even with LeBron James, who now just jacks up three. So I think that's something the league is going to have to look at going forward. It can be exciting, but now it seems like that three-point shot has become given even more meaning because that's who wins the game, the team that makes more threes or at least shoots a higher percentage.
I agree. And obviously, if there's no three-point shot, and I'm not advocating for that at all, because I do think that it has very much has a lot of value in terms of making the game exciting and getting a lot more different types of players involved. I do think it's a little too prevalent and maybe you need to look at different ways. Maybe you move it back. Like you said, get rid of the corners. I'm not sure. You know, it's something that you really have to think about. But if there was no three-point shot, this Miami Heat team would not be at this point in, you know, they wouldn't be in the finals. Maybe they don't even make the playoffs. You know, that's sort of their secret weapon to overcome the talent deficit is those guys who are undrafted that we kept talking about. they happen to all be really good 3-point shooters. You know, that's how they made the NBA. That's how they're sticking around the NBA. And that's how they're having an impact in the playoffs. And you know, the last thing I want to say about it, Sap, is before the sort of rise and change and evolution of 3-point shot, not even that long ago, I'd say like 5 years ago, if you were to show somebody a box score and say, don't look at the points, tell me who won the game, just take out the points part of it and tell me who won the game. You'd look at, traditionally, what you look at is who won the rebounding battle and who won the turnover battle.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, or sorry, the other game, game two, Denver won the rebounding battle. The turnover battle was close. It was 11 turnovers for Miami, 13 for Denver, but Denver won rebounds 38-31. That's how you usually would tell who wins, is those two stats. Not so much anymore, Sap.
No, it was Pat Riley who back in the 80s coined the phrase, no rebounds, no rings. Well, apparently you can get out-rebounded and win a ring because you can take more threes and hit more threes, and that's what the whole game is about. It feels like pop a shot at some point, right? Like, let's just cut everything else out and just line up threes and take them. And the strange thing about Miami is they weren't all that great in the regular season shooting threes. They have been in the postseason, and they also have this weird ability to hit maybe 35% of their three-pointers, but it seems like half the games they're at about 50%, and the other half they're at about 20%. So when they're bad, they're bad. When they're good, they're good. And when they're good, they win. So just enough to get through these series. And the other ironic thing is their best player is not a really good three-point shooter and doesn't take many of them. And Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo is not really a three-point shooter. They have these specialists, whether it's Duncan Robinson or Max Strus or Gabe Vincent, Caleb Martin destroyed the Celtics. These guys can get hot, and let's not forget one of their best 3-point shooters, Tyler Hero's played what, about 12 minutes so far in the postseason, and maybe he comes back for game 4, or game 5, or whenever. So yeah, it is just one of the oddest playoff runs I've ever seen, because it's a team that was this close to not even making the playoffs. They
right.
lost the first play-in game to the Atlanta Hawks, and then they were trailing Chicago in the fourth quarter. So they were this close to not even qualifying, and here they are just blowing through teams. It's going to be interesting to see what happens the rest of this series. I still like Denver. I think they're the better team, but it's not going to be easy. I picked Denver in 6 because I have so much respect for Spoelstra and that whole organization, the players, the coaches, Pat Riley on down. They're just not going to give up. They're just not going to give up. You're going to have to beat them. They're not going to beat themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And so game 3 tonight, obviously it's paramount for both these teams to win that and take a game lead over the other team. To be honest with you, I have no freaking clue what's going to happen at this point, Sap. I felt very confident in my Nuggets in 5 pick after game 1 and through about 3/4 of game 2. And now suddenly, I don't know. I do not know with this Miami Heat team. On any given night, they can seem to just figure out how to win. And, you know, I think that the teams that they've knocked out, the Celtics, the Knicks, and the Bucks, are all sitting at home shaking their heads saying, how the hell did this team beat us? And it could be in a matter of, you know, a week and a half, could be the Denver Nuggets doing the same thing, Sap.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about these two teams, one of them is going to trail after game 3. Neither team has trailed at any point in the postseason. Again, Miami kind of did in the play-in, but since the playoffs started, they won game 1 in Milwaukee, never trailed in that series, took control with a game 1 win over the Knicks, and then they were up 3-0 against the Celtics. Denver's really never been pushed. They were tied 2-2 in round 2 against Phoenix, but then they just blew out the Suns in games 5 and 6. So neither team has really been behind. One of them is going to be behind after game 3.
Yeah. So it'll be really interesting to see how this one plays out. We're obviously looking forward to it. We'll react to all of it, but there has been plenty of other NBA news outside the finals, as this league never sleeps. A lot of interesting moves in the coaching department, not just head coaches, Sap, but pretty established assistant coaches joining different staffs. We're going to talk mostly about what the Celtics have done, because we've talked so much about Joe Mazzulla and him being overwhelmed as a head coach. Well, they got a pretty experienced assistant coach to come join his staff, Sam Cassell, who has won a couple of titles as a player in the NBA, including one with the Celtics. He leaves the Philadelphia 76ers and Doc Rivers staff and joins Joe Mazzulla's staff. I think it's a great hire. It checks off what I wanted for the Celtics to do, which was get a former player who has won a championship before joining the staff. and somebody who's he has now been coaching for quite a while. I still think that to round out the staff, they need somebody who has head coaching experience, but this is definitely a good start, Sap.
Casale played 15 years in the league. He's been an assistant coach for 14 years, so he's been involved in the NBA longer than most of the players on the Celtics have been alive. So he has all of that experience, won two titles with Houston, one with the Celtics. And I just question why he's never gotten a head coaching job. He's been up for a few of them, and he's considered a top assistant. And you would think that at some point he would get that opportunity to be a head coach. Maybe he's the head coach in waiting. If the Celtics are 21-20 midway through the season, I'm sure they're going to move on from Joe Mazzulla. There'd be so much public pressure to do so that Sam Cassell would be the ready-made head coach, although he has no head coaching experience. I like the move as well. We talked about it once the season ended that Sam Cassell or Frank Vogel would be good choices. Well, Vogel now is the head coach of the Phoenix Suns, and Cassell, I'm sure, would like to be a head coach at some point, but this is a good move. He can connect with the players. The players generally do respect former players more than they do guys that didn't play in the NBA. And right. Mazzulla was a good college player at West Virginia.
Yeah, but he didn't sniff the NBA.
No. I mean, they're going to respect Sam Cassell more so. And Cassell can show up one day and, you know, put three rings in their face and say, I won these as a player. Sometimes I think that doesn't really impress players, especially if you've got a, you know, $295 million contract you just signed. You're like, okay, whatever. That's nice. That's ancient history. But I think that he gives them something there, and we'll see what his role is going to be. But they still got to round out that coaching staff because a lot of those assistants are moving on to Houston to be on Ime Udoka's staff. So there's going to be a couple more hires for the Celtics to round out the coaching staff.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that all the hires will be important because we saw how much the inexperience of Joe Mazzulla and sort of the odd personality quirks of him affected the team at times, and certainly his relationship with the media, which I'm not saying is, you know, the end all be all, but it would be nice if he could have, you know, an assistant coach who could do some of the media stuff too, that could take a little bit of the pressure off of him. So I still think, if I'm talking about the rest of the staff, I again maintain they do need somebody who has had some head coaching experience. I think that that is important. Whether the Celtics are willing to pay for that, I don't know. You know, Cassell is not going to come cheap as an assistant coach, I'm sure. But the staff needs to, I do think you need to overpay to overcompensate for the fact that Mazzulla is so inexperienced and that hurt you in the playoffs. There's no way around it. It hurt you.
Is there some former head coach who doesn't have aspirations to be a head coach again and would be okay being a consigliere? You know,
that's a great question, Seb.
Yeah, I'm thinking back, you know, okay, Sean McVay took over the Rams back in 2017, and Wade Phillips was his defensive coordinator. And by then, Wade Phillips was closing in on, I don't know, 70 years old and had no aspiration to be a head coach again. He was quite content being the defensive coordinator, you know, being Sean McVay's consigliere that McVay could bounce some ideas off of.
Right.
Is there a comparable coach? I mean, I always bring back, like, Tex Winter was Phil Jackson's assistant with the Bulls. He didn't want to be a head coach in the NBA. He was, you know, in his late 60s, early 70s. He was quite pleased with that particular role. If there's a coach out there like that, go ahead and find him.
Yeah, I think that would be great. You know, I think a lot of these guys get recycled in the NBA and, you know, are ambitious and want to be head coaches again. But that would be ideal, Sap, if you could find somebody like that. But I think that, you know, throughout this cycle, there's been some really strong assistant coaches being hired. Like, I loved Kevin Ollie joining the staff on the Nets. I thought that's a home run hire for them. I would have loved to see him on the Celtics, even maybe more than Sam Cassell. I think that he won a national championship at UConn, and he was so respected in the NBA by players he played with, Kevin Durant, chief among them.
I can't believe that at some point the Nets didn't hire him as their head coach because of his relationship with Durant.
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be something. Right, because I'm a big fan of Kevin Ollie. He won a national championship at Connecticut. I'm not sure what the hell happened at Connecticut. There was some sort of lawsuit settled. He actually received money, didn't have to pay money. But I always thought that he was going to be coaching, whether it was in Oklahoma City, because he had a great relationship with Westbrook and Durant, or in Brooklyn with Durant, because, again, he was such a respected guy who played on like 10 or 11 teams And when he was playing in Oklahoma City, he was the guy who kind of showed Durant and Westbrook how to be professionals. So they had that type of relationship, kind of like a big brother, little brother type relationship. So, yeah, that's a great hire, without question. Again, another guy, I just don't understand why he hasn't had the opportunity to be a head coach. You know, I know Charles Lee is someone that's being rumored to be a potential assistant coach with the Celtics. So, yeah, they'll round this out. And, again, I like your idea of having a former head coach who can kind of come in and help with the game management for Joe Mazzulla. And I think one other thing Mazzulla is going to need is some sort of media training. I think the Celtics are going to have to, like, teach him how to act in front of the media. He's the conduit from the media to the fans. That's a big part of his job. Just look at how Alex Cora handles that with the Red Sox, who are a bleep show. I mean, the Celtics had the second best record in basketball, and this guy was very combative with the media. Alex Cora is like managing, you know, a firestorm there at Fenway Park, and he handles himself really well with the media. Now, he's more experienced and just has that personality. So get some media training for Joe Mazzulla so he doesn't look like an a-hole every time Abby Chin or Brian Scalabrine or someone who covers the team as a beat reporter asks him a question, because that's a real turnoff for the fans. And, you know, at times it can be laughable, but at times it's sad.
Yeah, and it's not leading by example, you know, to your players. You know, you're the boss of the team. You're representing the team. You don't want to show them that that's the way you deal with the media. That's, you know, whether they like it or not, that is part of their job. They don't get paid just to play basketball. That's sort of a misconception. That is primarily what they do, but part of their contracts and their obligation is to deal with the media. That is literally part of their job.
That league has always been the friendliest with the media. I can go back to the days when I was, I'm not Bob Ryan here, but when I was in there, you know, covering games at the old Boston Garden, and I dealt a lot with the opposing teams as well. That's always been a thing at the NBA, that they've been the easiest to deal with. Heck, you could go to a Celtics game, they're playing the Atlanta Hawks, and Doc Rivers is playing for Atlanta. You go in the locker room, you know, 2 hours before the game. Hey, Doc, you got 5 minutes for us? Absolutely. And that, I'm using him as an example because he's at the other end of the spectrum, because he was always great with the media. But most of the players, even the star players back then, were very accessible. That's how they grew the league. And they were fortunate to have the faces of the league being Dr. J and Magic and Bird. Bird was not standoffish with the media. He was very cooperative when he had to be. He was great after games. But that's how you built the league, was with the stars being accommodating. You can't have a coach who may be the worst coach in the NBA acting like an a-hole, trying to be a combination of Popovich and Belichick. Well, those guys have a lot of titles, 11 between them. This guy, you know, had the most talented roster in the NBA and couldn't get to the NBA Finals.
Yeah, I think that the key for the Celtics coaching staff is experience, experience, experience. If they want to bring in Charles Lee, another longtime assistant coach who's been rumored for a head coach, I think that would be great. Just guys who have been around the NBA, if they want to add another, maybe even a younger former player who's trying to learn the ropes and could be on the second row of that coaching staff, I think that would be great too. But they can't just let Mazzulla pick and choose, you know, the stat guys that he likes and guys that he plays pickup basketball with, or maybe somebody from his dojo that he's learning karate with. They can't allow him to do that. They've got to surround him with guys who are going to challenge him, make him better at his job in with media and with coaching. So that will be important to see. And before we finish up here, Sap, there has been a really interesting NBA story pertaining to your favorite player, LeBron James, and my least favorite player, Kyrie Irving, as a rumor came out that Kyrie Irving has been trying to lobby LeBron James to join him in Dallas. Now, LeBron James is not a free agent. Kyrie Irving is. So sort of counterintuitive there. And the concept of Kyrie Irving being the driving force for LeBron seems sort of laughable, that, you know, LeBron would say, okay, yeah, I'll come join forces with Kyrie Irving, as opposed to the other way around. The Lakers don't appear to be interested in Kyrie Irving. I don't think LeBron's particularly interested in going to the Dallas Mavericks, nor is there any way he would really get there. So this is a weird story. It seems to have been leaked by Kyrie's camp, but for God knows what reason. I don't know why he does what he does, Sap.
No, we can't really get into the brain of Kyrie Irving. And like you said, it's interesting. Kyrie's not even signed with the Dallas Mavericks yet. He's trying to recruit LeBron James, who has 1 year left with the Lakers. Now, I think if LeBron wanted to leave the Lakers, he could probably force the issue and go to management and say,
not in conference. not trade him to Dallas.
Not in conference, right? So maybe, you know, to the Celtics for Jaylen Brown, we can only dream. But you look at that and just say, LeBron's going to want to stay in LA. He's got so many business ties there. He's already looking ahead to the day he retires, potentially being an owner in the NBA, probably with the Las Vegas franchise that could come about in 3 or 4 years or whenever the league decides to expand. He also has his son, Bronny, playing at USC. I think he's going to want to be close to him. That's so a there's point. A lot of factors there. So I think LeBron's going to stay in L.A. The Lakers are probably going to re-sign Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura. You already got Anthony Davis. So those are the four guys you kind of build around. You move on from D'Angelo Russell. And if you can tweak things, you know, maybe you make a run at it next year. Yeah, I'm not sure what Kyrie Irving is thinking, although, you know, Kyrie, LeBron, and Luka would be certainly interesting. I mean, if you could do Hard Knocks on an NBA team, that would be the one I'd choose with those three guys on the same roster. But yeah, Kyrie just likes to be heard, likes to get involved in newsmaking as much as he pushes back about it. He's a guy who says he doesn't crave the attention, then he starves for attention. I couldn't see how this would happen. I just don't see how it would happen because I think LeBron is going to stay in LA for at least another year and then decide what he wants to do to team up with Bronny, who will be in the NBA in the 2024-25 season.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the points you made are great. It also, you know, considering the fact that the Dallas Mavericks didn't even make the playoffs last year, you know, it's not like it's the sexiest destination. There is no state income tax in Dallas. That's nice, considering how much money LeBron James makes. He could pocket a lot more. But at this point in his career, I don't think that he's making decisions based purely off of finances. He has plenty of money. I think he's playing wherever he wants to be. He's the most comfortable. That's clearly L.A., like you said. His family lives there. One of his sons goes to high school there. His other son's going to USC. He's got tons of business interests there. The Lakers did have a pretty successful season, all things considered, should be back in the mix next year if they retain these players and maybe make another move or two. So I think he's quite content where he is, and I think Kyrie Irving has just no conception of the world around him and just sort of thinks things should go the way that Kyrie envisions them and says to himself one day, yeah, why not? LeBron James, why don't you come here and play with me? That's the draw, right? Is playing with Kyrie Irving in Dallas on a team that didn't make the playoffs. I just think he's a whack job and doesn't see reality for what it is, Sap. And I mean, again, if you listen to any of the episodes of this podcast, you know, I just detest the guy. I don't think he's a good person. He's posted some very unflattering things about Jewish people, and he didn't really ever apologize for it. And quite frankly, I think that he has shown who he is, which is a destroyer of teams. Every team he's gone on, he's blown up. And why would you, if you're LeBron James, why would you want to approach that at this point right now?
Yeah, I mean, if Luka's reaching out to LeBron, now we've got something there. But again, LeBron's going to stay with the Lakers because of those business interests and the family ties, obviously. So I think he'll be there. He puts it out there that he may retire. I think it's maybe to put pressure on the organization to make moves in the offseason to sign Austin Reeves and Rui Hachimura, who both really contributed throughout the playoffs, and to add pieces to maybe make one more title run as LeBron gets ready for his 21st season in the NBA. I mean, he's played more years in the NBA than he hasn't. So, you know, I think obviously we know he has a couple of good years left. His play didn't really dip all that much this year. I mean, his three-point shooting was terrible because he takes too many three-pointers. His defense can be spotty when engaged. He can still play defense. The rest of his game is pretty spectacular. He's still a top 10 player in this league, made third team all NBA and missed a third of the season with injuries. That's a pretty impressive thing to do. So I think he's still wearing a Laker uniform next year. And you know, Kyrie's kind of in fantasy land as he usually is.
Well, I think Sap too, just like the ego to say, I'm going to recruit LeBron James. Like, LeBron James is the guy that recruits you or other people. You don't go and say, LeBron, come join me on a different team. That's not how it works, you know, with guys at that level. I think that Kyrie views himself at LeBron's level, and is nowhere close to that. Nor has he ever been.
He was pissed when LeBron went back to Cleveland. He's like, what do we need him for? Well, I don't know. He's the best player in the world, and he's coming back home, and you're here to be the second best player, and you're going to get Kevin Love for Andrew Wiggins. And, you know, LeBron And Kyrie went to the finals three straight years. And if Kyrie doesn't get hurt in game one of the 2015 finals, which was their first year together, they probably win two titles back to back. That's how good that combo was on the court. But Kyrie wasn't wise enough to understand that LeBron's the guy. Now, when LeBron went to Miami, it was a little bit different because Wade had already won a championship and they joined forces as much as anything. And then LeBron brought Bosch with him to make the big three in Miami. But it was Wade's team. But quickly, Wade was smart enough to understand, I'm going to give this spot to LeBron because he's the best player in the league. And Wade was instrumental in making LeBron a better leader. And that's why Wade is such a great leader, because a great leader concedes some control from time to time. Kyrie has no leadership ability.
No, none. I mean, negative. And in fact, he makes everybody worse leader around mm-hmm. him. Yeah. I mean, LeBron is a smart guy, and he's a basketball genius. And believe me, he sees what's happened with Kyrie's career, especially since he's left him. And I don't think he wants anything to do with him. I think he, especially after they made a deep run in the playoffs, I think that maybe there was like some interest in him last year saying, yeah, the talent, if we could just get that in. But now I don't think he feels like he needs Kyrie. That he thinks maybe a couple tweaks and the Lakers could be right back in it. It's not like they, I mean, like you said, it was a close sweep. Like you said, Yogi Berra sort of talk. So they're not that far off. I mean, it's going to be hard for them to stay healthy. We know that. But the Kyrie thing, it's not happening. Kyrie's in fantasy land, like you said, but that shouldn't surprise anybody.
Nope. He's been there for quite a while now.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's going to do it for us here at the Pick and Roll NBA podcast with Jet and Sepp. Thanks to Full Press Coverage. Go check out their website. Lots of great content on there as always. And you can check out our social medias at JohnSapp25, at Jet Stryer for all sorts of cool stats, updates, musings, you know, the usual Twitter stuff. And we will be back to react to game three that happens, tips off tonight in Miami. So make sure you check out our show when we do that. And whatever other NBA news crops up, some John Morant stuff is obviously going to drop soon. Already some scuttlebutt about that on Twitter. And so, yeah, lots to talk about, Sap, and we'll be here for all of it. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we will talk to you later. See ya.